Welcome to Stock Stories, episode 126. Welcome to the Stock Stories Podcast. My name is Alex, and I am your host and stock storyteller for today. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. This is the show dedicated to helping you, the individual investor, make better investing decisions. And how do we do that? Well, usually on this show, we look at case studies of real companies. We look at the largest companies in America, and sometimes some of the largest companies in the world try to break down their history, their business models, and their financials in order to understand if they might make an attractive investment for us. And then also on this show, we study mental models. Mental models are kind of the philosophical underpinnings of the decision-making process. It's how we think about things, thinking about thinking. And so when we marry those two things together, we can make more effective decisions and become better investors. So that is my goal on the show, is to help make you a better investor. And it's been a really exciting journey doing that with you so far. Today is a little bit different, actually. First of all, happy Friday. Hope you're having a great, great day. Hope you're having a great week. Today is a little bit different. Instead of doing a case study of a company or a mental model, what we have for you is actually an interview. And I want to bring some different perspectives here on the show from time to time, because, you know, just me talking by myself, it's not going to grow you as much as sometimes listening to other people and getting their perspectives and learning new things from them. So I am very pleased today to introduce you to a conversation I had with a man named Marvin Barron. Marvin is part of an organization called Fineprints. And Fineprints is interesting. They're a startup that tracks political stocks. And so they are doing some really interesting things with data, trying to come up with different insights that investors can use. So without further ado, let's go right to the interview. All right. Welcome to the Stock Stories Podcast. My name is Alex, and I'm your host. So today I have a very special guest with us today. I have Marvin Barron here with us from Fineprints. Marvin, welcome to the show.
Great. Great to be here, Alex.
Awesome. So let's just jump right in. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do. What is your story?
Sure. So at Fineprint, what we're doing is we're taking all of the disclosure data. I'm starting with members of Congress and then expanding to legislative assistants, the executive branch, and eventually the states, where these individuals who are in positions of just immense political power also act as investors, and they have to disclose what their investments are. So we're taking that data, we're indexing it, scanning it, collating it to build a database so that we can share with our subscribers trends in investment strategy and approach over time by people with power. And we think that that's going to be interesting for a lot of people out there.
Okay, so analyzing the trends. So when I first came across your platform, it was really interesting to me because I had never really heard of tracking political stocks or necessarily tracking political investment activity. I think several years ago, I happened across some sort of filing from a congressperson. It was probably a link from a journalist in a news article somewhere, and just found it kind of interesting. But then I kind of forgot about it. And as I've grown as an investor, you know, as an investor, we're always looking for new sources of information and new trends and new patterns. And so this strikes me as something that's really interesting. So can you tell me a little bit about, first of all, where did this all begin? Where does your story start, and kind of how did this idea come up?
Sure. So my first round of my career was in investment management, and I worked at a small wealth management company, starting out as an analyst and then working my way up into a role as managing partner. And so I was aware, just kind of as part of the background noise, of some research that had been done in 2004, arguing that members of Congress significantly outperformed the stock market, right? And those research papers, which came out of the University of Washington, the University of Georgia, by a guy named Zabrowski, triggered a lot of legislative activity, culminating in something called the Stock Act, which really beefed up disclosure requirements by members of Congress. Now, at the same time, a friend of mine from college, a guy named Joe, he was familiar with this research kind of from the other end, because he has a political science background, and he was studying political science in the international domain, in the realm of transparency and issues like corruption, and sort of hopping from Chicago to he was at Cornell and then doing a fellowship at Harvard. So he was familiar with that research from the academic side. I was familiar with it from the practitioner side. And at some point we got together and said, you know, this would be an interesting project to work on, given our two specialties, if we ever have some time. And then a few months ago, we realized, hey, we've got some time. Let's really put some effort into this and dig into it. And I've got to tell you, Alex, I think if we'd known what we were getting into, with just how frustrating, how messy, how opaque, and how fragmented the data is, we might not have gone this far. But now we've come this far, and we might as well see it all the way through. So there's some interesting stuff in here, and it's really been highlighted by recent events in terms of the more transparent set of data, which are senators who have been very active traders during this time of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for that. So when you and your friend were first beginning to actually look at this data, mm-hmm. this was pre-Stock Act,
right?
Correct? Okay. So
well, we were aware of it pre-Stock Act. We were aware of just this sense that Congress beats the market. And then the Stock Act and the research around this seemed to support that hypothesis.
Okay. So when you all were first actually looking at the data, what were some of your thoughts and your feelings surrounding that? Were you frustrated? Were there things that surprised you or things that you expected, like when you first really started combing through the data sets?
Sure. I think the thing that was most surprising was really the narrative around this, because the dominant narrative is that members of Congress, there's a worry they might be abusing insider information and in some ways timing the market. But that's a very, very narrow and specific charge, when I think the bigger problem is the subtle and insidious effect of what happens when you own something and you have power to influence the benefits that something might receive. To what degree does that distort kind of the fundamental mechanisms of the economy in a way that might not be long-term beneficial for all of us? So I think as we've gone further into this, what we've seen is really a belief that the coverage of this matter from a local reporter perspective, from an opposition candidate perspective, from an ethics and SEC perspective, I think they have a decent handle on the very narrow legal allegation of insider trading. We've seen a couple of people brought up in accusations.
Mm-hmm.
But on mm-hmm. the broader question of, does owning an asset fundamentally change how people who are piloting the economy choose to pilot that economy? That's something that's a little more interesting and that we see. And I think an example that really stands out to us now is if we look at the top five holdings of members of Congress, just the most common stocks that are held by individual members, there's the ones that you'd expect: Apple and Microsoft, Walt Disney, General Electric. But then we see Bank of America and Pfizer. And they crack into the top 10 when they're really closer to 20 or 30th in the S&P 500.
Okay. So that's interesting. So these are still large cap companies, very well known, generally speaking, but they rank a little bit higher as far as holdings in aggregate politically versus what you would expect based on their market cap or based on some other, you know, metrics like revenue or things like that.
Correct. And I think our core belief is that, I mean, you have some background as a fundamental analyst. And when you're doing fundamental analysis, you sort of stack up your risk factors, and there's a risk line for political risk. And we always just sort of throw up our hands and go, well, I don't really know. Let's assume it's a good political country or a not good political country, and don't look any further than that. And I think it would be a little more useful to know that are there companies that are disproportionately held in the personal wallets of the people who are regulating and directing, you know, legislation around those companies. What we're starting to look into is, are there different sector analyses? So we've seen in general, separate from the COVID thing, because this was happening in January, a movement into energy and pharmaceuticals. And within energy, we could say that we're seeing a movement away from some of the more traditional energy generation sectors towards sectors like wind. So I think that this question of, can we add a little bit better data resolution to what is political risk, is something that can really supplement the other types of analysis that investors are doing.
Okay. I think that's definitely true, because I'm trying to think from the perspective, just as an individual investor, many people are listening to this thinking, okay, well, I'm just a man or a woman, I'm trying to pick stocks for my portfolio, for my family. How do I think about risk? And political risk is definitely one of those factors. And like you said, there's traditionally just hasn't really been this big kind of information source that's been obvious to really have a feeling about that. So can you tell me a little bit more about, when you're looking at political risk, what kinds of things are you looking for? Did you go into it trying to look for specific types of metrics, for example, holding period or sectors like you mentioned, or did you just start looking at trends and then go from there and kind of craft the metrics from there?
Well, you're making it sound a lot more advanced than we've gotten to. Really, at this point, we're just trying to get all the forms and get them into a database so that we can do this type of basic analysis and get some summary statistics in place. Now, when we are able to do that, and I'd say we're about 3/4 of the way into that process, then I think those questions are exactly what we want to ask. What are the trends that we're seeing over time on a sectoral basis, on a basic asset allocation basis? Do we see key members becoming more and less defensive? We did see, in sort of an anecdotal way, generally Congress became much more active as a trading entity in the first quarter of the year. So trading activity in the House, just by counting the number of trades, was up about 70%. Trading activity in the Senate was up about 30%, comparing against quarter one of last year. Right? And so, to some degree, if we boil down what's the core message of trading activity, it's that there are some powerful people who are paying more attention to their portfolios than they were at the reference time. And then I think it's up to other people to speculate, why could that be and what's the actionable that comes from that. So our vision is to really just be the data conduit there, because I think people bring a lot of theories to bear whenever they're studying political issues. And we don't want that to cloud our process of really just assimilating the data and making it available.
Got it. I understand. So you're trying to make the data as transparent as possible, because historically it has not been transparent at all.
Correct.
And people can use it for what they will, but at the very least, now there's something that they can look at, that we can look at, that says, oh, hey, you know, I can start looking at certain politicians over here that are traditionally involved in certain industries or have some sort of background tied to certain stocks, or you can look at any number of things, really. But What is the, I'm a little curious about the Stock Act pre and post. So prior to the Stock Act, as an individual investor, what would you have to do to have any sense of where politicians had their holdings? Or was there really nothing outside of insider knowledge that you could reliably count on?
So what the Stock Act did, this gets back into many questions about to what degree can you hold people who, by the nature of their job, have insider information accountable for potentially insider trading, right? So by one view, just being somebody with political power means that you're an insider, in the same way that, you know, just having the job of CFO makes you the insider for a specific company. And the way in which those ethics fights are carried out says a lot about the strength of the political unit. So if you dial them up and you say everything is an ethics violation, then because of the inherent nature of the position of power, what happens is whichever party is in power just systematically beats up whichever party does not have power, and the government just stops functioning. So there have to be some norms and guidelines about what's okay and what's not okay. And the original reporting requirements really go back to a lot of the changes that came about with Nixon in the 70s. But there was this growing belief that Congress was not subject to any sort of insider trading prosecution. And on top of that belief, there was this research by Zabrowski, which said they were outperforming. So the Stock Act really reiterated that, yes, they were subject to insider trading prosecution. And secondly, they had to disclose their transactions in a more transparent and regular way, including posting the transactions online in the form of annual and ongoing disclosures. Now, just because they're posting them online doesn't mean that you can compile them and say anything about them. So you have 500 different offices that might write, "I own Google" in 500 different ways. So our first task is to translate those ways, because at least they're consistent over time within each office, so that we can ask what we care about, how many of them own Google.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that, the translation of the data itself. So you mentioned top holdings before, like Apple and Disney. And I'm sure once you look at the regulatory disclosures, it's right there. Okay, Disney stock. What about other types of assets? I know this goes beyond stocks, right? I'm sure there's partnerships, there's bonds, any number of things. Are you all looking at those kinds of things as well? Or are you focused on a very specific set of data for now that you're trying to get together?
Oh, no, we want to expand, you know, quite a bit. And I think in some ways we're underselling the difficulty of just looking at stocks, because they don't report these assets with specific values. They report them in columns of checkboxes. And so the first column might be, I own between $0 and $1,000. The second column is a pretty big column. It's between $1,000 and $15,000. The third column is between $15,000 and $50,000. Right? So one of the things we want to do is use sort of more modern statistical techniques to backfill some of that data by cross-referencing it against financial markets data. So for example, if we're following somebody who bought Tesla 3 years ago, and Tesla has roughly tripled in that time, and we look at their annual disclosures and they haven't moved the category into the next box and they haven't made any transactions in Tesla, then we can retroactively go back and amend our estimate for what their initial position was from $1,000 to $15,000 down to something south of $5,000. So our first step is to set up that kind of range narrowing process for all of the positions, just so that we can have a better estimate of what people's net worth are. Right now, the publication that tries to track the net worth of Congress is a political publication called Roll Call. And their method is to look at these same disclosures and add them up by hand with the assumption that every asset's value is the smallest number in the range category. And we know that that's wrong. So can we do a little bit better than that? We were pretty confident that we can. Now, your next question was about how do we look at other asset classes? And that's something that I'm deeply interested in because my background and my company, we were a tactical asset allocator firm.
So can you explain really quickly what that means for the audience?
We were trying to generate our risk-adjusted outperformance, not by shifting assets between specific companies, but by shifting assets between asset classes based on their historic valuation. So the classic asset classes are cash versus bonds versus real estate versus stocks. And so if you were able to be in cash in March and not in stocks, that mattered kind of a lot more than which of the stocks you happen to be invested in, because the whole market retreated for a few weeks there. So the asset allocation question is in some ways the question of what is the general economic outlook that the investor has? And we think that's kind of the question that we view people with political power at having a unique position to have an opinion on. And that's what, in some ways, the senators who were accused of insider trading and probably could not be convicted of insider trading were alleged to have done. They were alleged to have gotten briefings on coronavirus and largely gone to cash. That's not necessarily the way we think of as insider trading, which is there's a company that's going to have a patent granted, and I know 2 hours before it is public, so I buy that company before anybody else does. Right? This is a more broad, sectoral, general economic question that we want to be able to study. And in that, we do see a reasonable amount of movement from the asset classes. And that lets us consider things like mutual funds, right, rather than just specific stocks, because we can put mutual funds into their basic asset allocation box and just know, you know, how are members of Congress invested.
Okay. So what kinds of things have you all learned from that research? What are some of the more popular asset classes for senators, for example?
I don't think we're at a level where we can parse senators versus tenure versus members of Congress, but I can say pretty universally, if you're in Congress, it's highly likely that you have rental property and are getting some income from rental property. And I think the next step that we have is to cross-reference the income people are seeing from rental property against estimates at the value of that rental property to figure out what cap rate they're getting. Because anecdotally, we've certainly seen a number of cases where members are getting, let's say, they're valuing the property in the $100,000 to $200,000 checkbox, and then they're valuing the income they're getting from it in the $50,000 to $100,000 checkbox. And I don't know, in my experience as an investor, if you can get a 50% cap rate on any sort of real estate investment, then you're just lights out, one of the best real estate investors that the world has ever seen. So if there's that many of them in one building in America, I just want them to tell me what they know that none of the rest of us do. So
yeah, sign me up, right?
I think that asset class question is useful. I also think what we want to be able to give people is a model portfolio and just say, hey, if you want to invest like a senator, if you want to own the portfolio that Congress does, then here are the things that you need to buy in this percentage breakdown. Because I do think that one of the things investors struggle with is having confidence in their investments during a volatile market. And I think the idea that these people with power are not going to let their assets go to zero, and so I might as well be along for the ride, that's an idea that I think has a lot of power for a lot of people.
In essence, these are some of the most powerful and connected people in America. If I, as an individual investor, invest like them, hey, at least we are somewhat on the same team as far as economically speaking in some investments or in some way. There's some sort of connection from an ownership perspective.
I think that's exactly right. There's some sort of connection from an ownership perspective. And there can be a belief that, at least in this small way, the politician is on the same side of the table as me.
That makes me think a lot about one thing that we talk about on the podcast sometimes, which is just insider ownership of a firm, and how, from what I've seen, that has correlated well with overall business performance and overall share price performance of certain firms that are owned by their employees, at least in some small part, because there's an alignment of incentives. And I think that's really interesting, because we're kind of balancing different types of philosophies. There's the whole conflict of interest question, which you brought up. You know, how okay is it to own something that you have a very powerful influence on? But at the same time, we're talking about the public markets. So in many ways, that's democratized ownership in a lot of ways. But, I kind of contrast that with, let's say there's a large, privately, closely held, family-based business that owns stock in its own company, and they have a lot of clout within their local community. Well, they're likely to try to pass legislation or what have you for their own interests. But I'm not sure if I'm really going anywhere with that, but it just made me think about the comparison between the politician versus, say, chief officers of a firm, whether publicly or privately held.
Right. And I think the analogy that we've used a lot is sort of reaching for the Pete Rose, the baseball player and gambler analogy. So for listeners who aren't familiar, Pete Rose was a very successful baseball player. Many people considered him Hall of Fame worthy, who was not allowed in the Hall of Fame because it came out that he was gambling on the sport. And so there's a lot of layered questions here. And people can have a very reasoned debate and take different positions. The first question might be, should Pete Rose be allowed to gamble at all? Can he go to Las Vegas and sit at a roulette table? And I think a lot of people will say yes, in fact, most people. Then we might say, can Pete Rose gamble on sports? He's an athlete. He probably knows a lot about sports. You know, that there's nothing really weird about that. Okay, well, can he gamble on baseball? Well, now we're getting into some hairier territory. Clearly, he might be an expert, and he would argue that, you know, this is an area where I have an expertise, and there's an element of skill to gambling. So what's the matter with this? You know, I'm a private citizen, and I'm trying to make a buck too. It gets even hairier if you ask, well, can Pete Rose gamble on his team? Can he gamble on games he's playing in? Mm. Can he bet for the other team that he's playing against tonight?
Mm. Right. Yeah.
And so I think that this question of, do we want to have our representatives have some degree of economic, personal economic alignment with the economic interests of their constituency? I believe that answer is yes. And should there be transparency about the data so that we can know if those interests are dramatically disaligned? Cases where we find where members are aggressively shorting the market. I think that answer is yes. And so should then that information be out there so voters can make a decision? Yes. And should investors be able to say, in general, which companies are receiving kind of the favor of Washington from a not words and speeches perspective, but from a wallets and savings perspective? Again, I think that answer is useful. I know that if I were an executive at a large company, and I was going to go testify in front of a committee, I'd want to know what members had personal interests in my company's success and what members had personal interests in my competitor's success. And I would be in my mind sitting there and cross-referencing their questions against their holdings. So again, I think to get back to where we started, what we're trying to do is demystify this line in the spreadsheet called political risk, which I think a lot of analysts have always just thrown in there as an I don't know, and be able to offer sort of more concrete statistics to guide some of the thinking that goes on there.
Hmm. Indeed. Okay. All right. So as far as the current data that Fine Print is collecting, you said it's multiple asset classes and looking at really just trying to, it seems like a lot of the focus right now is on that kind of statistical methodology that you mentioned of coming up with some more accurate, I would say, brackets of different timelines and different holdings of different politicians. Would you say that that's correct?
That is correct.
Okay. What other things do you think it's important for individual investors to know or to think about as you're thinking about this kind of data and all of the really limitless possibilities of these data sets? What other kinds of things do you think might be useful?
If we're to boil it down to one number we want to create and offer to our subscribers, it's a sentiment index of what the powerful are doing. Right? So the most tracked sentiment index in the United States is the Consumer Confidence Index put out by the University of Michigan, which is a survey question of how confident are consumers feeling about making major purchases. And while it's kind of interesting to me as an investor whether the new iPhone is going to be a big seller this year or not, in an environment where it looks like the government is going to be restructuring the economy in a way that's larger than at any time in the post-World War II period, largely in reaction to the pandemic, in an environment where it looks like unemployment is 25% and they've already passed around a $2-3 trillion stimulus, I think
right.
A more interesting question than what are consumers interested in and how are they feeling is where are the people with power putting their own money? Not necessarily because they're placing that money in advance of some windfall, although that's certainly a possibility if you're feeling cynical, but certainly because we know that the very act of owning something systematically changes our opinion of it. And that's a finding that comes out of behavioral economics and social psychology, and it's a fairly robust finding. So knowing what people own tells you what they're going to have a slightly more favorable opinion towards. And in a time where a lot of power and the power of the purse is going to be exercised, we think at the very least it's worth compiling and tracking that information. Now, where do we go from here? We want to compile and track this that information. I can envision a world where we might partner with an investment manager who wants to use this information directly to implement essentially an index fund of buy what Congress buys for their clients. So that's certainly something that's been discussed. This is, of course, a resource for people who are on the watchdog track in the better government sort of transparency groups. So just having a unified database where you can reference what are the trades that happen and highlight them from a watchdog perspective. I think there's value to that. And then Joe comes at this from an academic research perspective of just, can we have a data set to ask some of these basic questions like, do people from Texas, do they really invest more in oil stocks or not? Can we validate some of our hunches? And I'm really happy if the answer goes either way, because if the answer is the system looks corrupt, then that sets into place a movement for reform. And if we come out of this and we find, you know, the system isn't really that corrupt, people are just cynical, then I feel better and I have more confidence in our fundamental systems. So to me, this is a win-win, and it starts with getting the data. We have 10 years of data, 600,000 or so documents, compiling it into a database where we can make, you know, we can approach the questions of summary statistics and then opening it up in a way that lets the large number of people who will be interested in this data start to ask some of these interesting questions.
Yeah, I think you hit it right there. Is this kind of thinking really, it's really a way of thinking at its basic level, is going to open the door up to asking different types of questions that really haven't been able to be answered before, other than just anecdotally or in maybe a very small sense as far as data, like you mentioned earlier with the handwritten calculations of different holdings and different allocations that our politicians have. So I do think this really could be quite powerful just because of the amount of data that exists, and based on not just the data from because of the Stock Act and that's disclosed now, but also just the data that is already known and reported because people are in positions of power anyway, because these are public figures, there's already so much known about them. If there's, you mentioned like Texas and oil stocks, if there's senators from Texas, are they indeed investing in oil or not? And what does that say about where their interests align?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things we've seen is a strong move into wind by some members of Congress as an investment. And what's interesting about this is that wind power is something that's been prophesized to be on the rise roughly every 10 years for the last 50 years. And so one of the interesting questions that always confronts investors when they run into a good idea is, what makes a good idea take off and what makes it fail? You know, why did Facebook succeed when right before it, MySpace failed? And right before it, you know, there was sort of the rise and fall of Friendster. And we can go back to ICQ and AOL and Usenet boards. But the idea that you could create a profile and connect with people and network in some way, that's a pretty old idea. And when Facebook came around, you know, they were able to make it work. And people tell that story, they usually tie it into the marketing campaign and keeping it very exclusive to Harvard and then the Ivy Leagues and then colleges at first. But what they're fundamentally telling is a story that says the establishment had power here. And the presence of establishmentarian support allowed the idea to get some amount of critical mass. And once it had critical mass, then it could take off. And so I think what we're doing is trying to create some sort of tracking measure of where is the establishment making its bets. Now, sometimes you want to be betting against the establishment. Sometimes you want to be betting with it. That's largely up to the individual investor. I will argue that in all cases, it's probably useful to know where they stand.
I agree. Simply the act of knowing empowers you to make better decisions, whether you're an individual investor or an institutional investor or even a journalist trying to simply uncover the truth. There's value in all of those things.
Absolutely.
Okay. Wow. So I'm just thinking about this. I'm trying to think about, my mind is kind of going crazy with all the different types of possibilities. And I know that, you know, fine print is at the beginning stages now, in many ways, but is growing and is asking a lot of different questions based on the data that you all are finding. Do you have any other interesting insights from the data that you've collected so far? You mentioned top holdings, you mentioned different types of asset classes like rental property. Are there any other interesting insights from an investment perspective?
I mean, there's a whole lot, and it's really dominated a lot of our public-facing coverage in terms of possible trading around stocks that are getting popular related to possible coronavirus treatments. And there's certainly been some movement there, which people are looking at both from a good governance perspective, but also from a, if they're making this bet, maybe I should make this bet, because if we're going to give out 300 million vaccines, somebody's going to get paid for that process. So having some sense for what's going on there has really, I think, dominated a lot of the conversation for the last couple months. But speaking more generally, one of the things we're interested in is just what percentage of members of Congress are active traders. And I've got to tell you, it's fewer than you think. You know, it would be about 20% of members are active traders. Most of the time, they are not particularly aggressive traders. So what we're trying to do is build profiles for every member to figure out what their behavior pattern is, so that if they change it, that becomes a real red flag. Like, one of the things that made us think that members were starting to become more defensive in January is a member in Florida who's a very active investor. I'm not sure to say names, but he very routinely from year to year builds up a large municipal bonds portfolio ladder. And then in January in the new tax year rolls it over, it goes into cash and he buys new things. And this is a long-term pattern. And it's a couple million dollar municipal bond portfolio, but he's worth $60 or $70 million. So there's nothing from a best practices in personal wealth management, that would strike me as unusual that there's a lot of activity happening here, right? But this year, he didn't roll over the portfolio. He just liquidated the bond portfolio and let it sit in cash. And that's a pretty strong, there was such a deviation from the pattern of behavior that what we were able to flag that with is at least say, here's somebody who's getting more defensive. And I don't really need to get into the question of, is this person getting more defensive for quote unquote good reasons or bad reasons? I think the basic fact that somebody in power is getting more defensive and assuming a defensive investing posture is worth noting and worth advertising to the world, in case it's kind of the canary in the coal mine. And there were a number of members who took more aggressively defensive trading postures. You know, a member who shorted, a member who liquidated about half their portfolio around the end of the year, well before the coronavirus stuff became more well known, and probably well before anybody had received any briefings. But if everybody in power is getting defensive, that can cause the markets to retract. Right? In the same way that if everybody loses faith in the bank, that can cause a bank failure. If everybody in power starts to get nervous, then everybody's risk premium probably shrinks a little bit or probably grows a little bit.
So you mentioned this one politician who you noticed the deviation in their behavior, and that was very interesting. Is there a sort of threshold that you see just from like a data analyst perspective of once a certain percentage of people doing X action or taking Y action, does that ring a bell for you at a certain point? Is there a threshold that you think about? Or, yeah.
You know, I think we're going to be able to, you know, the hot word in startup world is always doing things with artificial intelligence and machine learning. But actually, I think there's a pretty good application here if we can get enough data. Because rather than rules-based thresholds that determine when is something abnormal behavior or not, using the existing trading history to set the pattern and look for deviation from that to trigger a manual review, that's ultimately our goal, right? So one example that we have about why sort of rules-based trend analysis isn't going to work is Congresswoman, I think her name's Deborah Lawrence, perhaps. She's from Detroit. And if you look at her disclosures, it appears that about half of her net worth is tied up in a single stock, Ford Motor Company. And so, you know, coming at this with some wealth management in my background, I'm like, this is a super concentrated portfolio. This is a big deal. It sets off all the red flags. And then when we actually dig into it, it's the case that her husband worked at Ford. He'd been awarded some number of options over the entire course of his career. You know, he had plugged his retirement savings into Ford and had some level of seniority so that it became, you know, a reasonable number of assets. But the bottom line story is not that they're doing anything weird with their portfolios. They're just Ford people in the same way that my, you know, great aunt growing up in the South owned Coca-Cola stock, and that was her stock. So, exactly. So being able to then flag that as this is somebody who is actively making bets versus has a personal affinity, I think is useful. And then on the other side of the things, you know, if we have somebody whose net worth seems to be relatively low, say in the $100,000 to $200,000 range, then smaller trades might set off our alarms, whereas somebody who's worth $70 million, a $300,000 or $400,000 trade might not be significant. That might just be a regular reallocation of their model portfolio. So we want to look at these things within the context of treating all of these members and eventually members of the executive branch and legislative aides as individual investors with individual investor goals that they're trying to meet, with the caveat of they might be in a better position to influence the direction of the economy than the other investors.
Exactly. Okay, so you're really, even though you're trying to gather as much data as possible and come up with many different conclusions, it sounds like there's still very specific cases, and really everything has to be taken in context because every investor is different. Whether they're a person in power or not, everyone has their own lives and histories and backgrounds and spouses and situations that can and do have an influence on their holdings at any given time.
Absolutely.
Have you ever heard of Quincy, Florida?
Quincy, Florida? No, I'm not familiar.
Quincy, Florida? Yeah, oh, when you mentioned Quincy, Florida.
Okay.
When you mentioned Coca-Cola, I immediately thought of it. There's this old story that I think it was back around, it was several decades ago, but there was a man who was obsessed with Coca-Cola in this small town in Florida, and I think he was a banker, and he started proselytizing to everyone in the town about Coca-Cola, eventually convinced many of his neighbors to buy it. And before you know it, this whole town had shares of Coca-Cola stuffed within their assets. And that concentrated position was so powerful for the town, it allowed them to kind of sail through recessions over the years because of the Coke dividends that were coming in. And so I do think, yeah, you certainly have those kinds of situations that are really interesting, whether they may be geographic concentration of different holdings, like, you know, Atlanta or Florida, our people are going to own Coca-Cola, and people from Detroit are going to own Ford Motor Company stock, for example. So I think that's really interesting how it seems like what you all are trying to do is look at the big picture while at the same time carefully noting objectively that there is specific context at play with individual people. We're still talking about individual investors making decisions.
Right. And I think giving voters the tools to cross-reference those individual investors making individual decisions and taking individual positions against their own self-interest, I think that that's useful.
Mm.
Right. Now, if in Detroit we found that the member was like very strongly invested in a car company that was not a large employer in Detroit, you know, I think then that enters into a political debate. and we want to provide the tools to support that debate in many ways without taking sides on it. Because there is this, long-standing debate in political science about what do we want our representatives to be? Do we want them to be, you know, the representative of the people in the sense of be like the median voter within their district or be like the average of all of the voters within their district? That's certainly one ideal that's been talked about. And another ideal is that we want them to be avatars, that we are in some ways not electing them as the average person, but appointing them as sort of an excelsior person to be more educated, to have a dominant position and make positions almost from a position of aristocracy that we, you know, poor huddled masses aren't able to make. And these two thoughts about how, you know, democracy should work, they go back, you know, back to the Greek times. So we're not going to solve that here and now, but at the very least, we can provide data so that people are how we're having that debate can have it on more concrete terms and a little bit of a less abstract space.
Wow, that's a good idea, and I think it just furthers to bolster the point that the level of information that we now have in our world and will continue to have is starting to become so interconnected that it's creating new questions, creating new possibilities. It's connecting people in ways that they otherwise would never have been connected before. You can have just a regular person owning shares of a company that a senator owns, and there's an alignment of interest there, like we talked about. And so that level of data and analysis is bring up the philosophical questions, or the political science type questions that you just mentioned, but also some economic questions that are really important. So it sounds like really, really cool work that you guys are doing. So over at Fineprint, what kinds of services are you offering right now? Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. So we're about 7 months into our process. We've collected all of the disclosure forms and are in the process of trying to read them into a database. It's a little bit difficult because about 20% of them are not machine readable. So even though it's 2020, about a fifth of members are submitting either handwritten or faxed documents.
Oh my goodness. So
figuring out how to include those in the mix is, we get a lot of paper cuts in this work. So once we can do that, then we're going to set up a newsletter service, and that'll be some sort of subscription service with the idea that people who are actively investing on their own behalf might be interested in just our daily alerts and tracking in some of our research pieces as we find trends just in the course of organizing the data. Small investment offices might be interested in this. People who are in the media might be interested in this. And so that will be our first paid service. Our intention is to have a free service, which is just, like I said, a sentiment tracker over the last week, over the last month, over the last quarter. According to the disclosures we processed, the population of people with power is getting more or less defensive as measured by their asset allocation. So we'll have the newsletter, we'll kind of have that sentiment tracker. And then at the highest end, our goal is to sell this data stream, offer it to, you know, data services like Bloomberg, offer it on a subscription basis to large media organizations, university research libraries, things like that. And then keeping it updated over time, that's going to take a lot of work. And eventually, then we're going to expand and start looking at other areas. You know, states are important. States receive almost no coverage. California, you know, they have legislators too. And if California was considered on its own, it would be like, what, the seventh largest economy on the planet?
So, yeah, something like that, right?
So getting into that, getting into the positions that people who are not necessarily elected, but are deeply involved in the legislative and administrative process at the aid level. They have to make disclosures as well. They just don't have to necessarily put them on the internet. So requesting those forms and integrating them into our population data set, that's something that we see doing with an end goal of always and always trying to get a clearer picture on what are the people who actually have the power doing in terms of placing their own economic bets.
Absolutely. Wow, that's a very awesome and noble vision, and definitely support that. That sounds really cool, and I think a lot of people will vibe with that message. Before we go, Marvin, is there anything else you want to share with the listeners?
We'd love to hear from listeners. We'd love you to subscribe to our newsletter at Fine Print Data. Follow us on Twitter, all the normal pitches there. But we are at the stage where we're starting to build out our product mix. And so we're deeply curious about what the population of active investors care about seeing. And it's a lot easier for us to set up the database in a way now such that data is easy to access and analyze later than to go and reconstruct things, you know, once we have some amount of path dependency. So we're always eager to hear from people who start their sentences with, it'd be really cool to know if whatever. And we can set things up so that that's a pretty easy statistic to get later on, most likely. So that's where we're at, and would love to hear from people.
Awesome. All right. And I will definitely be posting a link to y'all's website in our show notes and any other notes so people can get in touch with you guys. Marvin, thanks for the conversation. This has been really fun. It's frankly a topic that, as I mentioned, I kind of just scraped the edge of it many years ago, just looking through some regulatory filings. But this is a whole new world. And I think with the ability to analyze data and combining that with the political impact and the economic impact that you all are doing, that's pretty interesting stuff. And I think it could serve people well, not just economically, but also from whatever philosophical or moral perspective that they have, they can then have greater power to act based on more transparent information.
Right.
So I think that's a great thing.
Alex, thanks so much for having me on today.
All right. Thank you. All right. So I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. I certainly learned a lot about the political world as far as how it relates to investments. So yeah, that was a fun conversation with Marvin.
And let's think about really quickly, what are some of the things that we learned from this interview? I think number one for me, the number one thing is just simple awareness. Awareness that politicians in America are making big investment decisions and they're doing it for their own families' portfolios. So that has a lot of implications because they're people in power, because they have the power to actually influence the law, influence the entire system of how the country works, and in turn have effects all over the globe. It's really important to see what kind of things that they're actually doing with their own money. And because of the requirements for disclosure that they have in place, there's actually some possibility of really doing that. And until recently, there hasn't been a lot of technology that's been able to sift through that data and analyze it in a thorough and organized way. So I think that's really powerful just to recognize that that actually exists now, that we can be aware of things that are going on. And I think number two is understanding political risk. What is political risk for a given asset, whether it's stocks, whether it's bonds, whether it's some other type of assets? What is the political risk? And do a senator from Texas's investment portfolio, does that actually align with the oil companies down in Texas's interests? There's just so many different kinds of questions that can be asked there. And so I think having data like this could be really interesting, really important. So I think that understanding political risk, that's another takeaway. A third takeaway that I have is that I found it interesting that so many people in power own rental real estate. It seems like they own a lot of stocks as well, but rental income seems to be a favorite for congressmen and congresswomen and senators. So that's just a little tidbit of trivia that I found interesting. I think it's just really interesting to learn about what people are buying and selling and to adjust accordingly. I'm definitely going to look into some of the research by Zabrowski that Marvin mentioned, because I'm curious about all of this outperformance that senators are having. I think it may be useful to try to look at that data to maybe glean some insights. So bottom line, there are so many different types of information that you and I as investors could look at. I mean, we could spend our entire lives just doing research on even just certain niches within the investment universe, and it would take a lifetime. But understanding what information is actually important and or actually viable is something completely different. And knowing the difference between the two can make a difference between being an okay investor and being a great investor. And I think that there's something here. I think that there's something related to political risk that could have a material impact on performance. If these studies, assuming these studies are correct and accurate. So I think it merits further research. So I hope that this interview was helpful to you. And I certainly enjoyed it. There's a lot of things here to think about, things that are just kind of different and maybe not talked about enough in the mainstream. So I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope in the future to bring more interviews like this to you. Let me know if you enjoyed this. I certainly love to hear from you. You can email me at alex@stockstoriespodcast.com, or you can DM me on Instagram @stockstoryteller. So either way, I'll get a message from you. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. The information presented here on Stock Stories is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. You and you alone are responsible for your investment and financial decisions. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, or financial advisor that can analyze your specific situation in the context of your goals and circumstances.